Hello, welcome to the Satellite MarketCast podcast, where we feature key executives from leading satellite companies worldwide, talk about their company, their careers, industry trends, and other insights on the exciting satellite communication industry. I'm your host, Virgil Labrador, Editor-in-Chief of Satellite Markets and Research, inviting you to another informative podcast with our featured guest today. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of the Satellite MarketCast podcast. And today we have a very special guest. He is Bruce Elbert. He's very well known in the industry. He's written several books on satellite technology, which are reference books on the subject. He's worked with Hughes, one of the foremost pioneering companies in the industry during the most exciting times of that company, and he'll talk about that later. Since 1998, he's been an independent consultant running his own consulting firm, Application Technology Strategy, and he's also had some very interesting work. He's done a lot of interesting work for various clients worldwide and that, so he'll talk about that as well. And I have to give full disclosure, Bruce and I have been working together almost since the beginning of my career. He's helped me a lot, both as a fountain of source on the industry. He's mentored me, helped me start the business, and gave me a lot of great advice. So I think we really would benefit a lot from Bruce's insights in this podcast. So, Bruce, welcome to this podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Virgil. Yes, we have known each other, been interacting a lot over the last 20 years at least. And it's been good for me to know you. You're a good friend. And the way you look at things is a very practical and also open-minded approach. And I also follow the same thinking. I try to be objective all the time. And in my case, I do things from a scientific and engineering basis. But of course, this being a commercial industry, it's got to ultimately make financial sense too.
Right, right. And likewise, Bruce, you know, I've really benefited a lot from our friendship and our cooperation over the years. I'm not a trained engineer. You know, my role, is really more to popularize technology. I understand technology, you know, like you, I have a master's also in, you have an MBA, and I have a master's in communication management, specific for management. So I think there's a lot of synergies there. And like I said in the intro, I think, you know, those who haven't worked with you yet would really benefit them to avail of your expertise. So let's start with your company, Application Technology Strategy, Bruce. Give a brief overview of your capabilities and what you do for the industry, or what you can do for your clients.
Yes, well, this is a small firm, and it's primarily me as the principal consultant and contributor, but I do have relationships with others. You are one of the people. Mm-hmm. A number of other people contribute to me from time to time based on their expertise. Also, their view of the industry, how they come at it, what part of the world they're in, what services or applications are closest to their hearts. But ATS endeavors to cover everything in SATCOM. So that's space and ground. And in my career, you mentioned the years as an engineer, as a systems engineer, as a project manager, as a business unit leader in the industry. I got involved with many projects from the beginning to the end at all phases. So that exposure is a tremendous basis for me to be able to contribute as a consultant in any particular area that comes up, because frankly, that's what I was doing when I worked for Hughes and for CompSat, which established the Intelsat system early on. So that basis moves well into being a consultant. So, you know, what kind of consultant am I? I'm a consultant that can look at a problem or at a need and help the client put together a structure or modify a structure, and that could be an organization, that could be an actual system, to better meet the evolving needs and to solve problems as they come up. And, you know, I am a very good problem solver, identifying what the issues are and the best way to go about them. That what's important is all the experience that I gained up through 1999, when I retired from industry after having been 25 years with Hughes Electronics out in California. And so that was the company that originally developed the geostationary satellite concept. When I joined the industry, the first Hughes satellite was already up and operating and providing service, and there were more to come. Then I moved from CompSat, the first satellite operator, over to Hughes, where, as I've said, I spent 25 years. So right. During that time, I got exposure to the space segment, that is the satellite itself, how it gets up there, what makes it work, and how it delivers services, communication services in particular, and the ground segment needed in order to complete the link to wherever it goes, as well as to control and operate the satellites. And that experience was in implementing the system in the first place for a customer, and also operating the satellites for services, because Hughes got into the satellite service business with a satellite called Galaxy that I was director of for a period of time. But I wasn't limited to the United States. I worked in other countries, in Asia in particular, but also in Latin America and Europe, as well as North America. So I have, by virtue of that period of time through 1999, a global basis in this technology. And it was fairly easy to become a consultant. Obviously, you have to acquire clients.
Right.
And people always want to know, how do you acquire clients? There are several ways to do that. By reference is a good way. And some of my early clients were former customers or former workmates at Hughes who had moved on to other organizations. And then, you know, your reputation exceeds you, so to speak, in a good way. And other clients come to you. Now, you mentioned the books. The books were wonderful as far as getting my name out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of people use those books to learn about the industry. And some very senior people have thanked me for those books. As recently as the last satellite conference in Washington, D.C., somebody said, "Bruce, I realize now you're the person that wrote that book that I read a few years back that really got me started." So I've learned how to communicate what the technology is, how it works together as a system, which is very important to apply satellites, since it is a rather large scope that you're dealing with.
Yeah, it's pretty, talking about the books, your books are really pretty comprehensive, you know, because unlike, I've also written a couple of books, but mine is really popular. And I'm, like I said in the introduction, I'm not an engineer, so there's no, I purposely didn't put any mathematical equations there, so a layman could, but yours is very, very comprehensive, and you have that engineering background. How many books have you written already, Bruce, on satellites?
Well, on the website, I identify 8 books. There are second and third editions in there, so there are more than 8 that I've actually put out there, but there are 8 titles.
And like I said, they're pretty comprehensive. I've read a few of them, you know, and it really it's comprehensively covers the various aspects of satellites. Yeah, going back to Hughes, you know, for those who aren't familiar, you know, since Hughes has changed quite a bit since the beginning, it's really a pioneering company. They created the geosynchronous satellites, right, under Harold Rosen. Did you have a chance to work with him when you were there, Bruce? Because he worked there he started the geosynchronous satellite, what was that, about the early 60s. But I heard he stayed there until he retired, right?
He retired and came back again and kept working.
Yeah.
And then, as you know, he passed away just a few years ago at the age of 90. And we celebrated that at one of your events that you hosted, I think, out in Las Vegas.
Right.
It was a great opportunity to remember Harold Rosen. So Hal, as he was known to the people that worked closely with him, the rest of us called him Dr. Rosen. The first time I met him was when I was called in from vacation to answer some questions about Ka-band amplifiers. Now, this was in 1973. I had only been working for the company for a year, but I was one of the few people that had worked with KA band, because up until then, everything was C band and KU band. The lower frequencies had really been developed and exploited, and KA band was a new regime. Nobody has really put anything up yet. And we had put a satellite together working with NEC of Japan. And I guess he had a review with management and they had questions about that amplifier and that repeater. So I was called in and I went into this conference room and I knew what he looked like because I'd seen him in the hall and I knew who he was, of course. And he's sitting there and he says, "What is this about this amplifier, this KA band amplifier? Where did you get that?"
Wow, coming from Harold Grosen, the Dr. Harold Grosen.
No beating around the bush, always jumping right to the heart of it. That was Dr. Rosen, and anybody that worked for him a long time was unique. You know, these were special people, and I would learn from them because they were people that I could spend time with. Right. So it was a tremendous period of education about the satellite itself, because I knew about communications already.
Right.
But the satellite in our industry is a core element. It's got to work right. It's got to last in orbit and everything else associated with that. And it does. Right. It's a remarkable thing that we can depend upon being so far away.
And you've worked with the real pioneers, Dr. Harold Rosen, among others, and you've known all the executives that use the famous ones.
The others were scientists and engineers under him at Hughes, which is the company that had developed the concept, funded it internally until NASA decided to take part, as well as the U.S. Air Force. So that led to the first launch of CINCOM in 1963, and then a new company called CompSat, or the Communications Satellite Corporation, was convinced that this technology of a geostationary satellite was the way to go. And of course, those of you that have been around a while know that it was Arthur C. Clarke, the noted science fiction writer and futurist, who was the one who put out a paper. Was it in 1945?
Yeah, it was in October 1945 in Wireless World, Extraterrestrial Relays. Very, very visionary.
Extraterrestrial paper. Relays.
Yes. Yeah, that's where he came up with the idea that if at a certain distance from the Earth, which is around 36,000 kilometers or 24,000 miles approximately, the satellite would be moving at the same speed as the Earth's rotation. So that's the geostationary satellite. But Dr. Harold Rosen was the one who made it practical. So Arthur Clarke never, as you know, Bruce, and this is just for the benefit of our audience, Arthur Clarke never actually patented the idea because he thought that it would take many, many years or decades for it to be commercially viable. And at that time, patents were only for 17 years. But about less than 20 years later, actually 18 years later, 1963, around that.
Doing the math. It's not that long, is it?
Yeah, so he just missed it by 1 year when Harold Rosen perfected the geosynchronous satellite, you know. Well,
and you know, that characteristic of the satellite being fixed in the sky still makes it very effective for a lot of applications today and in the future. So it is not overwhelmed or overtaken by the use of other orbits. And so we know that satellite communications has moved down from that 36,000 mile altitude down in steps to lower altitudes as low as 350 kilometers, which is being exploited now. So we have lots more satellites up and going up. And a lot of excitement about the industry, because it's not just geostationary satellites. Right. There are many, many more in the lower orbits, and they can offer some capabilities that the geostationary can't.
Right. Well, go back again, to get the perspective of your wide experience. You know, you spend a lot of years in use, but But you've already mentioned the work you've done with KA Bank way back in the early 70s. Can you just highlight some of the key projects that you were involved with at Hughes?
Well, the first thing I worked on fed off of work that I had done at CompSat at KA Bank, because CompSat was looking ahead to when the C-band would be all fully occupied and needed some additional frequencies. And the frequencies were there, but you needed equipment, specifically a satellite design that would make effective use. And one thing that comes with KA band being a higher frequency and a smaller wavelength to go with it is that you create spot beams very easily. So instead of one beam covering the entire planet or a continent or a country, you end up with spot beams so that to cover the United States, it might be anywhere from 50 to 200, depending upon where you want those spot beams to go. Mm-hmm. So that leads to a different satellite concept, a different architecture would be the term we would say. And then the system on the ground also changes from what it would have been with the classic C or KU band. So we looked at that at CompSat, and we had R&D, research and development, being done in-house and by outside partners, like NEC, for example, was a partner that I was monitoring. So then when I go to Hughes, they say, hey, we've got this KA band project we're doing for AT&T Bell Laboratories. Mm-hmm. Now, Bell Laboratories is gone, but it was the premier non-government private sector research organization. Right. It was the top of the top of engineering and science as directed towards communications. Right. That's what AT&T could sponsor and could employ effectively. So thousands of engineers working on advanced ideas like the transistor, for example, came out of Bell Laboratories. Fiber optic cables came out of Bell Laboratories. And they wanted to be strong in satellite also. But they didn't have the expertise that Hughes had in satellite, having built the first geostationary satellite, and had the other components like the amplifiers, for example, that would go into the satellite. Well, they signed a contract to do R&D on a repeater, that is to say the radio frequency electronics at KA band that went inside the satellite, and also the antenna with the spot beams.
Right.
All right. And that was being managed by an individual who was a good technologist, but not particularly familiar with the KA band. So I came in, and initially I was backing him up, and I ended up talking to all of the specialists in Hughes, and they had amplifier, antenna, power supply experts, filter experts, every component. Of course, I'm a communications engineer. I know functionally what all these things do, but I don't design amplifiers or antennas.
Right.
That's what they do. So I bring it together to make sure it's going to work and meet the requirements of AT&T.
Right.
And that was the first project I worked on. That individual who was running the project had a medical problem, had to go on leave. I ended up taking over the whole project.
Right.
As a relatively young engineer and new to the company, and I orchestrated all these people in these laboratories, and I put together the report. And one of the engineers, because the engineers give me the write-ups and they're unreadable.
Right.
Those engineers didn't write. They experimented. They designed. They built. They didn't write. Okay.
Right.
So I became the writer. This, of course, is the genesis of me ultimately writing books, is taking material from these experts and making sense out of it and communicating it. I have to tell you, Virgil, like 6 months after the project was over and they had tested that repeater and it met all the requirements.
Right.
They didn't go ahead with the project.
Right.
But it was a success. That fellow who went off on medical leave, when he came back, he called me on the phone. He said, Bruce, I have a note from the head of the technology division who is over all of those experts. He said that's the best report he'd ever read.
Right, right. Wow. That's a great story.
I was blown away by that.
Yeah.
I could show him the flaws in that report, you know?
Yeah.
There were lots of
flaws. Well, I haven't read that report, but I did read your books, and I can see where, you know, the genesis of it, or, you know... Because your books, even though they deal with very complicated topics, they're also quite easy to understand and very well written, you know. And then you cite examples too, you know, and then back it up with all scientific.
Gotta have the examples. That's what I learned in college.
Right.
When you write a lab report, you have to have your data.
Right.
To support what you say in the report. So there's always got to be data.
Right.
And Hughes was a wonderful, just like college was a wonderful education process that whatever it is, if it's going to work, it has to be based on reality.
Yeah. So, you know, was there any, I know we have limited time, you know, but we can, in future, we can invite Bruce again for another podcast. But I think you spent most of your career at Hughes, and I'm sure that was one of the most fruitful times of your career. So if you can just highlight maybe one more, what is the one project that you were most proud of or, you know, to be part of at Hughes? Apart from that, what you just mentioned.
I asked that same question of a fellow by the name of John Fraser. Mm-hmm. And John Fraser holds patents. You mentioned patents earlier mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. He holds patents in telephone communications, particularly undersea cables, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And Hughes hired him. Mm-hmm. And he was already in his 60s with white hair. He looked like Einstein, if anybody. Okay.
Right.
And he was the kind of guy that didn't take any guff mm-hmm. from anybody. So he and we would get into it a little bit.
Right.
Because I'm a young whippersnapper, and I think I know satellite communications very well. He, of course, knows telephone very well for having worked for AT&T for 30 years already.
Right.
Bell Laboratories.
Right.
Patent holder. Okay.
Right.
So I asked him, what was the best project he ever worked on in his career? And he said, the Palapa A program for Indonesia.
Wow.
That's the one I worked on. I was in charge of systems analysis.
Right. Yeah,
and
that's
John
quite
was responsible. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's quite a project because that was the first satellite by a developing country. And it was only, if I'm not mistaken, the fourth country in the world to launch it for a developing nation, you know, in the 70s, you know, Indonesia, just after the US, the USSR, Britain, and I think France came the Palapa system. Oh, Canada, actually.
Canada was the first domestic system. And The Director General of Communications of Indonesia approached the head of Hughes Space and Communications, Dr. Albert Wheelon, mm-hmm. who went by Bud Wheelon. Mm-hmm. He approached him at a conference and said, I'm interested in having you put in a satellite system for us in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. That kicked it off. So in 1974, I was asked to join that project. Mm-hmm. I finished up the KA band. Now to go to C band, really standard stuff, mm-hmm. off the shelf, supposedly.
Right.
But a unique system for Indonesia that would both be the nationwide television distribution network, so that the Indonesian television network, which has the acronym TVRI,
Television
Republic of Indonesia, right?
Right.
And that take that network off of the island of Java and spread it out to Borneo and to New Guinea and across Sumatra. You know, we're talking about 3,000 miles across that country. And how many 18,000 islands? Pick a number.
Yeah, 16,000 at the low tide.
Still counting.
But a few hundred, only a few hundred are inhabited, actually. But, you know, most of them are concentrated in the main islands of Java, you know, where about almost two-thirds of the population lives.
That's right. And Bali is very popular because that's a unique culture there.
But people don't know that Indonesia has four time zones, you know, just...
Yeah,
more than the amazing. U.S. It's such a spread out country, and I'm glad you mentioned that as one of your projects that you are proud of? Because you know, in the history of the industry, that is also touted as one of the most successful and most impactful. You know, Indonesia at that time was still a developing country, still finding its identity. It's a mishmash of about thousands of islands and about 200 languages. And satellite technology through TV broadcasting via satellite actually was a key part in unifying the country, you know, and coming up with a single national language, which is Bahasa Indonesia. You know, that's why their country's motto is Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, you know, unity through diversity, you know. So that they.
It's like in pluribus unum. It's just like
something like that, yeah, from many one, and this one from
many one.
Right. Bhinneka Tunggal Ika. And satellite technology was a key game changer in affecting that. And now, you know.
Isn't it?
You were part of that.
I was part of it. I was an early part of it because there had been some studies and they were going to be getting the contract. So that I joined as the person that would take it from the paper design into a real hardware system. Now, Hughes had resources. We could build a satellite. We could get it launched with a Delta rocket provided by NASA. With ground stations, and we had a ground station division that had already built a very large ground station for Brazil and was in that particular business. One thing that group had done is they had provided the Earth station for when Richard Nixon went to China in 1972, when China opened up. And they broadcast back all of the events, including the dinner in the Great Hall of the People. Using a ground station designed, constructed, and operated by Hughes people, this ground segment group. So they could do it, but the requirement was for 40 ground stations. And the discussion between Dr. Whelan and the head of communications, they decided to break it up into three blocks of ground stations. We built 10 of them on Java, Bali, and Lombok Islands. And AT&T built 15 in the eastern half, and Philco Ford, which is now Loral, they built the other 15 in the western part. So, but the design would be mine. Okay, now the design had been started. What I was able to do is take the experience of Intelsat and bring it in there, because I brought with me that background from CompSat. And the team that was there, they were already working on it, so we could just make it better. And it became a tremendous interface and integration challenge of bringing these pieces together, and we had 2 years.
Wow.
We got it done, all of it. And I spent 6 months over there continuously, and lots of other trips, and visited a lot of different sites. I crawled all over telephone exchanges, climbed a few towers, tried not to do much of that, stuck to the ground as much as possible, did a lot of testing, right? It's a big testing challenge, where the only way to communicate with the other end is through the satellite, and you're testing that satellite at the same time. So it is a challenge. So it was decided that on the country's birthday, which is August, and I think 1945, does that sound familiar? When they got their independence? So in August would be the country's birthday, and that's when we would kick it off. And we kicked it off with a ceremony with the president of Indonesia making a phone call from his office in downtown Jakarta, our ground station out in the country that we built over the satellite, and first to the tip of Sumatra, Banda Aceh, to all the way to Jayapura in
Papua New, well, that's New Guinea, yeah. Irian Jaya. Yeah, which is used to be part of New Guinea. Yeah.
Correct. It's a dividing line down
right,
the
west
of
west
that big
West
island.
New Guinea. Yeah.
West
yeah, that's the easternmost end of Indonesia. So from the westernmost end in the Aceh to the most eastern part. Yeah.
So I don't know if you've heard this story, but when I was standing there with the communication equipment in the ground station, making sure everything was working right while the president is making his phone calls. And you have to realize that the people he was talking to, especially in New Guinea, they had never spoken to the president once they left.
Right.
Once they left Jakarta. So the governor of that New Guinea province finally gets to talk to the president.
Uh-huh.
And he doesn't know that there are all these people observing and the press and all that. They had just recently had an earthquake and destruction out there within the last month.
Right.
So what does that fellow do? But in Bahasa, Indonesia, the language, talking to the president, he is telling him that he needs helicopters. He has finally a chance to talk to the president. He's telling him about all the requirements they have for aid. First telephone connection.
That's
the story of communications, isn't
that
it?
That is. And that really epitomizes why this industry is so, good. Because it has that social impact, It really puts communities together, and then they provide vital services, not just when things are all going right, but also when things are going wrong, for emergencies and disasters.
That's the time when satellite shines, because the satellites are totally separate from the Earth. And if they're designed and operated correctly, they are very reliable.
Right.
So that will always be there, but you need the ground working, that part of it. So that's more subject to failure. But just recently, we have the experience of the war going on in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the Starlink system put up by SpaceX.
Right.
And it was discovered that they could use Starlink terminals in the Ukraine because their internet wasn't dependable enough. And then we find out there are thousands of Starlink terminals in the Ukraine, and it's become a lifeline for them. But it's not just the Starlink terminal and the satellites, but it's also the gateways. So there has to be a gateway in Europe for that Starlink terminal to connect to. So I just wanted to point that out.
Right.
That's a part of any kind of infrastructure by satellite.
Right. Right. So you spend a long career at Youth, and then you finally retired from Youth in around 1998. And then what made you decide to start your own business, to get into the consulting field?
Well, I had been very interested in doing this since approximately 1988, when I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about going from being an employee to becoming an independent consultant and what the expectations were. In fact, while I was working on my MBA in the 1980s, so that's was a good 5 or 6 years later, not that much actually, 4 years later. Isn't that interesting? Relatively quickly, it seemed like a long time. In this MBA program, economics professor, Rusty Rustfold at Pepperdine, and I was talking to him about becoming a consultant. And he was a consultant as well as a professor. And when I told him I wanted to do that, and I was 42 years old, he says, Bruce, you have to pay your dues. Well, I was really chagrined at that. And some of my buddies in the class, my classmates, they were saying, hey, Rusty, no, Bruce has got a lot of experience. That's not all it takes. Okay. So it was another almost 20 years, 15 years at least, until I had a lot more to work with. And then when you become a consultant, you're on your own. Okay, right. So my retirement from Hughes gave me a base, a financial base, to be able to be develop a consulting practice.
Right.
And one of the things that I was taught by somebody else, when I handed them this other person who I highly respect, I handed him my business card, which had my name, Silver. He says, no, you need to have more of an identity than that. So I came up with first application strategy.
Right.
And I got the domain name. And that's still the domain name for my website. But as you pointed out, the name of the corporate entity is not application strategy, it's application technology ATS.
Okay. Right.
So there's a little bit of a complication there that the website is applicationstrategy.com.
Right.
The corporate name is application technology strategy, LLC.
Right.
Limited liability company. Now, why is that? I wanted to establish a corporate entity. There are reasons for doing that. Anybody in business learns about why you set up a separate corporate entity that's isolated from you, but has its own life, so to speak, and its own books, its own insurance, its own identity. There are all kinds of advantages to it. And the only disadvantage is it costs money to do it. So you need to have enough revenue to justify it. In order to get a corporate identity, my lawyer went ahead in California at the time and tried to get application strategy. It wasn't available. He says somebody else has a name similar to it.
Oh.
Use application strategy. All right. So right there in the parking lot, the lawyer's office, because he ran out to me as I was about to leave. In December of 2001, he says, you need to do something. I said, okay, I'll do a technology insertion.
Right.
Now that has two meanings, right? It's a double entendre. Technology insertion means you have some system that you're developing, but in order to make it work effectively, you have to insert a technology that you don't currently have.
Right.
That's one of the things I know how to do, a technology insertion. But here it was in the name. It was taking technology and inserting it in the middle of the name. So that's the play on words.
Very interesting.
That's how it got to be. In the parking lot, I gave it to him. He ran off. And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, really. So it's almost 22 years since.
You've
had a really successful, and like you said, I also am one of the pool of people that help you out occasionally. But you've been very consistent. You've you had a lot of work. You can't talk about all of them because some of them are still under non-disclosure agreements. So you are a real consultant. You know, in this industry, you go to a trade show, there's a lot of consultants, and some are, you know, there's consultants and there's consultants. But you really have you're the real deal. You know, you write books. You're actually a professor now. Talking about that professor, you also teach. You taught at UCLA and also do courses and stuff. So can you just point out a few examples of some of the work you've done in the last 22 years with application technology strategy?
Right. So I do a lot of engineering that is architecture design of a system, a new system, or to upgrade to a second generation of a system. And because I know all of the elements and I have a good appreciation for performance and cost, I can come up with a structure and I can estimate its performance and its cost without building it. I mean, that's what engineering is, right? You have to come up with a design, but you don't want to have to spend 6 months to get to a point where you can estimate. You need to do it earlier than that, and you need to do trade studies to see which the best arrangement is to do that. So that's a strength that I have that evolved over the years. and played well in Indonesia. It played well even in that AT&T project. Mm-hmm. And later on, when I went into satellite communication services and we had to come up with proposals for services, mm-hmm. you had to design something and then bid it. And then when you deliver it, it better be cheaper than what you're getting paid. You better have some margin. All right. So
right.
There's that aspect. So coming back to what I worked on, a lot of it was like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a second generation of a major satellite system I worked on about 5 years ago, they actually went ahead mm-hmm. along the lines that I had recommended for that satellite system.
Mm-hmm.
But the one early on that was the most challenging, mm-hmm. and I can tell you what it was,
mm-hmm.
You remember that Iridium was developed by Motorola
right.
in the early 1990s.
Right.
They formed a company called Iridium that was separate, but Motorola staffed it.
Right.
And they staffed it with Motorola people and people they hired from the outside.
Right.
To put together the operation side. But Motorola constructed everything. They mm-hmm. had subcontractors mm-hmm. like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin as mm-hmm. part of it. They bought antennas for ground stations. They had gateways in a number of countries. This was the first low Earth orbit, LEO, satellite system for continuous real-time communication. And it happened to be for cellular telephone kind of service to
right.
a handheld device.
Right.
I think almost everybody knows about that system. It's mm-hmm. still around. However,
right.
that system did not get enough customers quickly enough. And it went bankrupt.
Right, right.
It went bankrupt because Motorola decided they weren't going to continue to bankroll it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they could see it wasn't going to make money anytime soon because of the huge burden of debt.
Right.
They had a lot of stockholders too.
Right.
Well, in 2002, roughly, I was contacted by the law firm that was representing a group of investors who lost their funds and were suing Motorola
mm-hmm.
for misleading the public about what the system could do to justify the high cost of putting the system together. And then ultimately, the system didn't make money, even though it worked to a fashion.
Right.
So I could talk about it a long time. I got hired as the technical expert to mm-hmm. testify in court.
Right.
And
right.
I took a year to go through all the documentation
mm-hmm.
for Iridium,
right.
having to do with the satellite design and the test, the mm-hmm. handsets, how they were developed by Motorola and how well they worked, how the system performed, how it was tested when the satellites were launched and the gateways went into operation.
Right.
Ultimately, I assessed where the weaknesses were
mm-hmm.
in that system. So
right.
I had to learn about the Iridium system in detail so that I could then apply the principles that I knew to assessing the survivability of the system and the service and all of that. So
right.
that's an incredible learning process. And then I had to testify in court.
Mm-hmm.
To that effect, and that was that. I gave depositions also, so I was put on the spot a lot
mm-hmm.
about what I knew. And the law firm told me I stood up. I handled everything that was thrown at me really well. In fact, the other side asked if I was available to represent their clients.
Right. Yeah. So that's one of the key areas where you're very active at, right? Being an expert witness in trials or legal cases. I know you can't talk about them. You know, they're some of them are
not in detail.
Right.
And recently, I'm involved in one particular one that's very interesting. And I had to come up with a way of testing that satellite system to demonstrate just how well it did work or
right,
does work.
Right. Right.
So that the performance of the system is something that is near and dear
right.
to my heart.
Right.
So I'll always do very well whenever that's at issue.
You've been involved in some patent controversies too, right? And you've come up with some innovative ways of defending your clients, against these patent infringement, which is quite often happens more commonly now in our industry, especially now with all these new.
A fair amount, Virgil. It kind of peaks at different times.
Right.
I think it's on the slow side right at the moment. It may peak up again. I don't know. But let me say that that's not all that I do.
Right.
That's a significant part when it comes up. But the other consulting requires that I be aware and knowledgeable about the current industry, not the way it was 30 years ago, although I can talk about that all day.
Right.
But I have to talk about what's going on right now with the systems that are that have been developed and have gone into service and the new ones coming and the technologies that go into that, like digital processing, phased array antennas, optical links, including the satellite links, digital processors on satellites and software-defined satellites, and even software-defined networks.
Right, right.
Okay, so I have to be able to speak to that.
Right.
So I stay aware of it. And you know that I go to the conferences. Sometimes I speak at conferences, but I'm more of in the background than up there on the platform telling everybody that I know what the answer is.
Right.
I don't know what the answer is until I've studied the problem.
Right. So you're on top of all these developments, Bruce, and then you're more than capable of providing advice or doing due diligence or studies or even building the networks themselves and designing it, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I do. And I work with the resources of the client. Recently, I think about 6 years ago, I was assisting NASA looking at the next generation for the Tracking and Data Relay Satellite, TDRS. That's a system that's been up and operational for over 30 years. I was around when it was constructed in the 80s, and they were looking 5 or 6 years ago at how to plan for its future, and one of the options was to look at commercial alternatives, something that the government likes to do, let private industry make the investment, take the risk, the government can use it for their purpose rather than it being a government system. So I was brought on board as the commercial communication expert.
Right.
I worked with the NASA people.
Right.
They were on my team.
Right.
And so it was a collaboration. I was inserted into NASA for that. We all speak the same language. It's just a case of, who do you work for? Well, I was working for NASA for a certain period of time, not as a NASA employee, but as a consultant.
Right.
So that does happen.
Well, that's in a nutshell, Bruce's career and the highlights of his career, and he's still ready, willing, and able. He's really a fountain of knowledge and sage advice. I can vouch for that. He's helped me out a lot. And we have limited time, so a lot of it is on his website. So we can go on applicationstrategy.com. Applicationstrategy.com. That's where you can find him. Like I said, he's available for consulting, research. Anything with satellites, I can't think of anyone better at that, you know, from both the engineering, marketing, implementation, application part of that. He covers everything. So Bruce Elbert, President of Application Technology Strategy, thank you very much for this very enlightening podcast.
You're very welcome, Virgil. Thank you for inviting me.
All your listeners out there, thank you for listening to this podcast. And for all the news and information in the global satellite industry, you always have Satellite Markets and Research at www.satellitemarket.com. And this podcast is also available on our YouTube channel, which is Satellite Markets. Thank you.